this is kind of funny, because I think the last seminar that I ran or was in charge of was back in grad school, and I fell asleep in the middle of my own seminar, and this was an indication that I needed to stop and to find something else to do with my time. Well, we'll get some bonus time here. Questions, what are those? All right, my name is John Jackson Miller. Welcome to Star Wars Celebration. I kind of like to walk around, but I'm hoping I'm not going to take a header off of this thing here. We'll see how it goes. The fine folks at Random House have sponsored me here to do a talk to you guys, a seminar about what I call Rule the Galaxy Together, Writing in a Shared Universe. While I have done hundreds of panels at different conventions over the years, and I've been on some panels about writing, I have never really done a panel about how to write that came from me. And I know a lot of other authors do that. They'll have their blogs, which are all about tips and tricks and that sort of thing. I've never done it because I tend to view writing as something completely organic that I can't explain. I sit there, I go into this sort of a fugue state for several hours, and by the time I'm done, you know, I've missed my children's childhood. Many hours have passed, but I have a story. This is a good thing for me, a bad thing for them, but the good thing is the stories I get paid for so that their years of therapy will be, you know, subsidized. But I've always looked at it as almost like jazz, where you just sit there in front of the keyboard and you got something by the time you're done, and pretty much, you know, whenever I give the work to somebody else to read, the first thing I say is this anything? Is this actually a story? Is this whatever? It is not as though I am one of these authors that is going to give you, you know, the Ten Commandments or the 15-step program to your novel or whatever. Or here is where you put your theme and your structure and your everything else. I am not that cat. I have 50,000 comic books. I have many, many novels that I've read over the years. Somewhere from doing all of that, I kind of have a sense of what a story ought to be or what it ought to feel like, and at least a way as I've been fooling people for the last 10 years in that regard. Rule the Galaxy Together, Writing in a Shared Universe. Now, a shared universe can mean tie-in fiction of the nature that you know, you see done in a building like this, Star Wars, or another franchise. But it can also mean your own fan fiction universe where you're working with other people. It can also mean any kind of a collaboration where there is a story that is shared between you and multiple other people. You know, I even did little exercises like this back in junior high, where all of us would be writing a single story in the classroom, and everybody would write a different chapter. And I remember when we did this thing, they gave me the anchor leg, the last story, because they knew I would make sense of all the other chapters that had come before. And in fact, that's exactly what I did. But again, it's not necessarily fiction that we're talking about. It could be comics. It could be a role-playing game or a video game universe as well. You have the same sorts of concerns going on. How do I make sure that I leave story opportunities available for other people? How do I make sure that I don't use any more than I need? How do I make sure that I don't get so stuck in using the trappings of whatever the universe is that I miss the story? And it's something that has just come along over the course of many years of doing this that I've kind of figured out a few of my own personal ground rules. I've done some Star Wars books. The very first one I did was almost 10 years ago, an issue of Star Wars Empire. It was a Darth Vader story with Darth Vader as sort of the detective in a mystery. And that led to my getting Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic at Dark Horse. Knights of the Old Republic, incidentally, is coming out in an epic collection from Marvel in July 1st, I believe it is. And someone tweeted to me today that all of those issues are now also on Marvel Unlimited. So that is wonderful. That stuff's getting out there again. I've done comics. Knights of the Old Republic, of course, ran 50 multiple odd issues in different iterations. I have done short fiction. Star Wars: Lost Tribe of the Sith is probably where a lot of you saw me first. These were short stories that I did for Del Rey that took place in between the Fate of the Jedi novels. And those we eventually collected in a large edition, and then I did a comics sequel to that with Dark Horse. Knight Errant is really a comics prose hybrid, where I wrote a novel for Del Rey and a graphic novels for Dark Horse at the same time. So I've gone that direction with it as well. And then I've written full-length novels such as Star Wars Kenobi and Star Wars Jedi. You haven't heard about one or two of those. And then I have even done some works for the role-playing game, Knights of the Old Republic, the campaign guide. We did that for the Star Wars role-playing game that WotC Wizards of the Coast did some years ago. And each one of these was one of these things where it is working within a shared universe with other authors, people that you might not meet or ever see, but you want to make sure that you are, cohabiting the same universe without causing problems with each other. I've done a lot of Star Wars, but I've also done a lot of other licenses as well. My first professional work was Crimson Dynamo at Marvel, which got me Iron Man for a year. Iron Man led to pretty much everything else. I wrote the Mass Effect graphic novels, the first three for Dark Horse, with the BioWare theme designer of that game. I've written Simpsons. I've written Conan. I have done some more video game work here very recently. A new video game that's coming out called Smite with Dark Horse. Indiana Jones, I wrote the adaptation for Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull a few years back. And I have even found time to do my most recent novel, which is Star Trek, and you just will have to forgive me for that one. I can let you know that, first of all, only guys who have the initials JJ can do both Star Wars and Star Trek. and if that's not good enough for you, I would lend you the words of a certain Ambassador Spock, who says, "Infinite diversity in infinite combinations," or Darth Vader, who says, "There is no conflict." It's all fun, to me, whatever sandbox I'm playing in. So I've done this over the years, and you would probably think that I got started because I have been writing comics and writing stories as long as I've been reading them. Since age 6, I still have most of the stuff I did when I was a kid. You would probably think, a lot of people ask, you must have done a lot of fan fiction, Guy. I didn't know what it was. In the 1970s, when I was a little kid, in the 1980s, I was not yet a part of fandom. I didn't know that it was a thing. I didn't really find out that it was anything until I was in high school, and there were a couple of girls that were writing Marvel Comics stories that had a certain nature to them. And they all mostly involved one character, and it was many years before I learned that that was called Wolverine slash fiction. I have to say that that's kind of an amusing term. But it doesn't mean what you think it means, I can promise you. At any rate, I wasn't doing any of that. I was doing my own stuff. Detective Duck was my character from when I was 10 to just about forever. I did 50 issues of that. I wrote them as if they were movies. That's Detective Duck BC, the preview to the sequel to Detective Duck 1. Luxury 105, I did 40 issues of that. That was a space series. I did, on my own, a Smith Corona typewriter before I got a computer. I did 14 volumes of the Treehouse Gang. So that's the Treehouse Gang and their gold mine up there. And then, thank God, my parents got a photocopier. And that's when I started to sell my own comics within school. Firefall Digest was an anthology that I did. And of course, and that's one of the reasons that I was using my own characters. I was a capitalist. I wanted to be able to sell these things. And, you know, then I discovered fandom in the mid-1980s, getting Comics Buyer's Guide, the newspaper that I would eventually go to work for about 13 years. And Comics Buyer's Guide, I discovered that there was this this world out there of people that were trading back and forth their mini comics. The mini comics movement of the 80s and early 90s is basically the forerunner to web comics. We would produce them on photocopiers and send them around every place. But they were all, again, my own characters and stories. Why did I use my own, even though I was still a huge Marvel fan and a fan of all the Star Wars and everything else? Reason was, in part, I was a terrible artist, as you can see. Yeah, certainly I was doing stories that were just spins off of Star Wars or whatever. You know, that's not quite a TIE Fighter there. That's not quite the Millennium Falcon there. That's actually the Duck Hawk, the Duck Hawk and Captain Star Ducks comic. I was trying to think about a spaceship. I didn't think about ducks, apparently. Because I could draw ducks, I thought. I knew I couldn't draw those characters, so I didn't want to try to make my own because they looked like they weren't official. They looked like they weren't real. This stuff at least looks like it's mine, even though it was terrible. And I also had the experience that in seventh grade, our class were all submitting to the city of Memphis. All the city schools and county schools had a competition called Wordsmith. And you were supposed to, you know, it was a writing competition. You were supposed to submit your own fiction. I wrote a story, a sort of film noir mystery story called Detective Duck and the Case of the Silver Sassafras. Really goofy sounding story. And I turned it into my teacher, Miss Ellen Burns. Everybody loved Burnsy. Burnsy was a former nun from Brooklyn and down in Tennessee. She got the story and she read it, and she both wrote this and said this to me. I still have the sheet of paper. "John Miller, I love your story, but you should be ashamed of yourself because Detective Duck is not your character. You are using plagiarism, young man." And I was like, plagiarism, that's not even quite the right word. And secondly, I brought in 50 copies of Detective Duck that I had written. This is mine. I wrote this. These are my characters. And she apologized, and we sent it off, and it came in first place in the division. And that was sort of my thinking of, okay, I know what I'm doing, but also I need to use my own characters whenever possible, because doing something else may limit the horizons of where I can take this. Now, I am not talking bad about fan fiction. I really am not. It is useful for practice, for sure. Anything that gets you writing for an audience, anything that gets you writing, and I don't just mean fan fiction, but I mean writing articles for your local newspaper about the high school football team, anything that gets you writing where people can see your work, that is critical to becoming a professional writer. That's what you need to be doing. And so it is certainly useful in that regard. You know, and what you do can also be turned into something else. It can be transformed. I mean, look, I don't want to look, but look at 50 Shades of Grey. Fiction where they changed the names. They changed the names because they wanted to be able to sell it. What you can't do with your fan fiction is sell it to the publishers that produce the tie-in fiction. It doesn't matter how good it is. It doesn't matter how much you care about it. Legally, contractually, most of these guys cannot legally look at it. I own Detective Duck. I license to Prudy there the rights to do Detective Duck novels. But Erin there submits her a fan fiction that is Detective Duck. I said, this should be your newest book. Well, if Prudy publishes a book that looks sort of like or anything like what she's done, Erin can sue both of us, saying that we've misappropriated her work. The way that publishers tend to work is they just don't look at anything, and I don't look at anything either. I feel for everybody who says this stuff, because I know they pour their heart out into it, but it tends to be invitation only. And that seems to be how it works. I've had people sending me stuff for years, and I have to say, I can't look at it, and it's rough, I understand. People say, how do you get in then? Well, here's how you get in, if you want to get in. There's not a whole lot of jobs in this business, but if you want to get in, basically you need stamps on your passport. You have to have done something else. I got Star Wars because I had done Iron Man. I got Iron Man because I had done Crimson Dynamo. I got Crimson Dynamo because I had been the editor of a magazine in the comics industry for 10 years, and I knew a guy who was at Marvel at the time. But once I got Marvel's work, it basically showed the next license holder down the line that I could work in their universe without ruining it. That I could work in their sandbox without causing problems for the next person down the line. That I wasn't just there to get my fingerprints on everything. That I wanted to represent the license the way that the license holder wanted it represented. And basically, it really is like a passport. One thing opens the door to the next. Because each one shows the next editor down the line, this person is responsible, this person hits deadlines, this person does not go out and set his behind on fire on the internet, causing problems or whatever. This person can do this work and make our property some money and make it look better, hopefully, than it would. So I've come up with some sort of ground rules that I live by. Respect the park and keep it clean. Pablo Hidalgo really likes this line here from Lucasfilm. I treat Star Wars or Star Trek or whatever license I'm working in like a national park. It is holy ground. It is something where I'm a visitor to it. I want to leave it either as I found it or a little bit better. As they say when you're camping, pack out what you bring in. I try not to leave my fingerprints on everything. I try to write stories that have limited footprints so that they're not impacting and affecting a whole lot of different things. This novel, Kenobi, takes place over just a couple of weeks of Obi-Wan Kenobi's life. And A New Dawn takes place over maybe 3 days. It's a very small amount of time. It is something where you want to try to tell stories using the universe or whatever shared universe it happens to be, but you don't want to cause problems for people further down the line. A pitch that will be rejected in 15 seconds is going to be something along the lines of, hey, look, I've come up with an idea. We're going to say that Leia and Luke were just two of three triplets. And there's a third kid out there or something like that. Or I don't know. Anything that you would do which messes with not just your story, but every other story that's out there is something that is bad form. And it is also usually going to be stopped at the editorial level or at the level of the licensor. Because, again, this is what's special about tie-in fiction, is there's two groups of people looking at things. There's the editors for the publishing company, and then there's also the license holders. So I try not to leave fingerprints. I try to leave story avenues open. And most importantly, I never say never. Words to avoid in your stories. And again, this is whether it's your fan fiction in a group of other people or whether it's in anything else. Words to avoid. There had never been a Wookiee chancellor. For the first time, they elected a Wookiee chancellor. It was unprecedented for a Wookiee to become chancellor. There would never again be a Wookiee chancellor. That's the worst one, because you're messing not just with the stories before you, but the stories that come afterward. No one had ever visited the Wookiee planet, or no one had ever visited whatever. Ooh, bad. Because again, understand what's happening in shared universes. You need to be able to build out stories in both directions, going forward and going back. And so you need to be able to limit your footprint to what your story needs. And in particular, all blanks were blanks. All Wookiees were good swimmers. Well, that is something which is now in there on the Wikipedia page forever and ever and ever. And suddenly, if anybody does a story with a Wookiee who is not a great swimmer, we've got to figure out a way to write around it. So, yes, never say never. Instead, words that are your friends. Weasel words. Some Wookiees were good swimmers. Many, but not all, Wookiees were good swimmers. Explanations varied about how Wookiees did this or how that thing worked or whatever. Popular opinion held that. Some people thought, or if you ask Han Solo his opinion about Wookiees and their swimming abilities, that way it's not a declarative statement coming from the narrator. In Star Wars in particular, the narrator shows up in one place in the movies. Where is that? Probably going wrong. So when you're writing prose, however, there tends to be a narrator, or comics. What do you do then? Well, I blame the speaker. So look at these two sentences here. For over 1,000 generations, the Jedi Knights were the guardians of peace and justice in the galaxy. Or, for over 1,000 generations, the Jedi Knights were the guardians of peace and justice in the galaxy, Ben said. I have put that line in the mouth of a mortal being. Ben could be wrong. Ben could be drunk. Ben could be mistaken. Ben could be lying. Would Ben Kenobi lie to Luke Skywalker? Oh my gosh, I bet he would. I bet he would. This is wonderful because it means that, you know, you don't have to, take that as gospel. It means that you can write around it. The problem that I ran into in Knights of the Old Republic when I was doing the comic series is that I didn't know what facts from the video games were said by characters and what facts were actually in the cutscenes and what things were just in various pieces of dialogue where it wasn't declarative statements. And so I was going back and searching and searching and searching and trying to figure out, okay, this particular fact about who used the Darth's name as first, or whatever, was that in somebody's mouth? Did somebody say that, or was it actually a declarative statement? And you end up doing more research in that situation. I try to do all of my history, all of my info dumps, and you need to really be careful about doing the info dumps anyway. The multiple paragraphs of here is the history of this particular thing. I try to put most of that in weasel words or in somebody's mouth. That way, you can blame them if it's wrong. You can go into a different direction at some point. Now, as we're writing, it is so much fun to work in a science fiction sandbox or a fantasy sandbox or something like that. You get to work with all the cool characters and all the cool devices and all the cool locations and everything. You really want to have fun, and particularly if you're the first-time author working in a venue or working in a MOU, you want to say, hey, look, I know my stuff. You can trust me. I dig Mass Effect. I dig whatever the thing is. You can recognize that I've invoked certain things. This is the problem, though. You're not writing for people in that universe. You're writing for Earthlings. Shared universes are great generators of jargon. But each use of jargon potentially limits your audience to the readers that you or your franchise already has. A series is more than its trappings, so you really need instead to focus on getting the feel right. Now, this isn't so much a thing about tie-in fiction as it is about fiction and science fiction in general. It was the case in the 1950s, when science fiction was fairly fresh on the scene, that you were trying to make things feel otherworldly. You were trying to use terms from that universe. Everything had a specific name. Please give me the Phaedotron. Oh, you mean the spoon? Yeah, that's what they would do. And so frequently, here's two choices. These are two possible lines, one of which went into Star Wars and New Dawn, one of which didn't. Kanan's eyes, every bit as blue as the coral on Dathomir, narrowed as if he were Naga Sanal looking at his first lignin crystal on Phaegon 3. Choice two, Kanan squinted. Well, the first line has problems anyway, because this is purple prose. This is ultraviolet prose, actually. But also, who is this being written for? You're trying to give people comparisons so that they will know what you're talking about. Not so that you can show your bona fides that I understand what universe I'm writing in. Kanan's eyes, every bit as blue as the coral on Dathomir. How blue is that? I don't know. Narrowed as if you were Naga Sadao. Who's he? Looking at his first lignin crystal. What's that? On Phaegon 3, where's that? If I'm not willing to explain each one of these things, I don't need it. If my story is not about what each one of these things is, I don't need it in my story. It's one of the things with writing this is you have to sort of say to yourself, what is going to be the common frame of reference for the people that are familiar with this particular franchise or tie-in role? What's the thing most people are going to have seen? In Star Wars, it's the movies. Find the word Rodian in one of the original Star Wars movies. It's not there. You all know it. It comes to mind immediately with you guys, but the fiction is read by people in the hundreds of thousands. The movies are seen by people in the tens of millions. And you kind of want to write for the largest audience you possibly can, and that is the way I tend to approach things. As I write on my website, farawaypress.com, where I have sort of behind-the-scenes notes on a lot of the things that I've done, there were a lot of characters in A New Dawn that I didn't mention what their species were. They were different various species, but some of them were characters like Munes. Well, you would know what a Mune was if you saw one on the screen. And in fact, in my comics are just absolute zoos. There's thousands of species in the comics because I've got somebody who can draw them, and people can look and say, aha, that's a hammerhead. They didn't have to know, oh, an Athorian, that's a hammerhead? That's what that guy is? You want to try to make it as easy as possible for as many people as possible to get on board and talk about things. And if it was relevant, if Naga Sadao or if one of these things were relevant to what I was talking about, yeah, you put it in, but you explain. So, and if you do put that stuff in as well, you also need to know that you don't have to have it hitting people over the head. You can make it sort of subtle. You can make it so that the people who are in the know will know what you're talking about. Some of those characters in A New Dawn, you can figure out what species they are just because I describe them. You don't necessarily have to have the entire backstory of everybody. So that is what I have to say about writing in universe. Again, well, when we did A New Dawn, we made a change. The refreshers are gone. They were replaced by bathrooms. This is again another case of that. Does the bathroom function any differently if it's a refresher? I don't know. You don't know. We don't know. Why use that name? It just limits the number of people who understand what's going on. Going back to that whole thing about pulp fiction and science fiction in the 1950s, they were trying to make it feel otherworldly by using other names for things. Star Wars does not need any help seeming otherworldly. It's already Star Wars. So, we can use elevator if we want to. We can use bathroom if we want to. It's in terms of term. Now, the best of us will make some mistakes. If we're working with other tie-in authors, we'll get things wrong. We'll either get things wrong about the basic concept that we're writing about, or we will not have read a particular thing, or we'll just have a total aneurysm. I gave William Riker a trumpet in my most recent book, not a trombone. It was an aneurysm moment. It's there. But under normal circumstances, you can do something with the errors that you make. You can eat your mistakes. If you work in a bakery, that's what you do. It didn't come out quite right. You can make your mistakes, as Slisk and Dan Griff there from Knights of the Old Republic. What eat your mistakes means is turning past errors into story opportunities. It grants the writer the use of 6 words of incredible power. Oh yeah, I meant to do that. Hold on.
7 words.
Hold on. Oh, there you go. See? More often than not, particularly if you're doing something where there are multiple chapters or it's a serial or a comic book or something like that, you have a good opportunity to come back later on and figure out a way to work things together. You're going to see something here that nobody has really seen before, I don't think. This is the first drawing that Brian Schenk ever did of Jor-El in the Knights of the Old Republic series. I asked Brian to draw an Arcanian. Who would be a powerful warrior woman and give her a weapon. And this is what he drew, and he gave her this light staff, and he gave her these multiple tattoos, and when Michael Atiyah did the color key for it, he gave her this sort of alabaster skin and white hair, and I looked at that and I said, wow, what a great character, so much better than I could have imagined. And then I found out what Arcanians really look like. Arcanians have very sort of pale flesh. They have 4 fingers as opposed to Jor-El having 5. They have no pupils in their eyes. They have what Walt Kelly, who did Pogo, used to call the blunted out eye look. Little Orphan Annie with no pupils in the eyes. So they had that as well. And also, Jor-El had a couple of things they didn't have. Jor-El had 20 elf ears. They didn't have elf ears. And they also didn't have tattoos like that. I looked at it and I said, I have no idea what these tattoos even are. What does that mean? Does it mean anything? It doesn't have to mean anything. And then I said, you know what? Rather than have him change this great design to make it look more like something that existed before, I figured, well, let's see if there's a way to go forward and basically, as we said, eat our mistakes. I took the idea of her skin being the different color and having 5 fingers, and I made 1 story arc out of it where she goes back and finds her people, the offshoots. I took the idea of the tattoos and I made another story arc out of it, and I won't give that away, but that's one of the stories I'm proudest of, what her secret history was, what the tattoos mean. They're actually words. And then finally, the elf ears, got a complete other story arc out of it. 3 different story arcs out of 1 drawing. That is being an environmental author. You're using what's available. There are other episodes like that. The Fate of the Jedi authors, Aaron Alston and Troy Denning and Christy Golden, they gave me the story bible for Lost Tribe of the Sith. What the Lost Tribe was like, what they would look like eventually. And I was to write the backstory for them. And the things that I noticed immediately were that they were all human. Well, the time that they came from, way over here in the Golden Age of the Sith books at the time, they weren't all human. We had the red Sith species, and the humans were all their slaves. And also, they had red lightsabers. And this was also a problem it was an opportunity. Because back then, the Sith didn't have lightsabers. They were carrying around these big, nasty old swords. And also, the Jedi that had lightsabers, they weren't regular lightsabers like you would expect. They were what I call the curling irons, because they all had cords on them that attached to their battery packs on their hips. And why did they do it that way? Well, very obviously, if you're going to do a novel that has Sith on it, you want red lightsabers, and you don't want to have to go explain all this other stuff. I looked at it as an opportunity, and so I got plot lines out of in that story. I got one story in Lost Tribe of the Sith about why it's only the humans that survived, and how this was originally their slaves that were on this planet. The lightsabers were explained in a different part of the story. The story did not exist, though, to explain these things. And that leads me to the final point here, and this I think is critical, because it's easy to get caught up in all of this stuff. How stories connect is not a story on its own. Your story has to have a reason to exist beyond connect the dots, beyond tying this thing to that thing. My newest piece of Star Wars fiction is just now out. It is Star Wars Insider 157. It is a tie-in to both Paul S. Kemp's new novel, which is just out here, I think it's just Mysterious Galaxy is selling it, The Lords of the Sith, and it is also a tie-in to A New Dawn. There's a character from A New Dawn that is in this book. There's a moment in New Dawn that is referred to. This is the moment. And I don't know how much I can say about it at this point, but I think it's out there. Is it cool? Yeah. We describe in Star Wars A New Dawn about Captain Sloan meeting Darth Vader. This is that moment. And it's my first Darth Vader story since the very beginning, 10 years earlier. So, but the story exists for a different purpose. The story does have those connections there, but the purpose of the story is to explain a moment in Darth Vader's life when he is just getting oriented. Orientation, in fact, is the name of the story, to life as the Emperor's stooge, his minion. And how does he feel about that? Because he didn't like being pushed around by the Jedi at the time. What is he going to think about being the Emperor's minion? And so the story has more reason to exist than to just connect the dots. Everything that it connects to is a wonderful opportunity. It's gravy. When they made the announcement about what was happening with the expanded universe and A New Dawn's role in it, a lot of people cared, of course. I cared. Everybody was invested in what had come before. I was certainly invested. I was in mutual funds, you know. I certainly, obviously, I put all the time into it. Everybody said, a lot of people said, John, how do you feel about these previous stories of yours? And I said, you know, look, I always try to write stories before, and I try to write stories now to stand on their own. How they connect to other stories in a tie-in universe is a bonus. It's gravy. It's an additional thing. But the story itself is the paramount thing. It is the key. You know, I went back and I thought about it. I have 50,000 comic books. I told you, I'm being treated for this. It's a problem. I've got to have an engineer come out to look at the floor. I'm not kidding. It's rated 17,000 pounds. When they fall in, they're going to crush my cars. And I thought about it. Maybe less than a third of them are in current continuity. And none of the Batman stories that I ever considered my favorites were ever in continuity. Dark Knight Returns, not in continuity. Batman Gotham by Gaslight, not in continuity. Batman Year One, not really in continuity. And I guess maybe also because I had come at this from being a comics fan, you know, we had understood over the years that there's this sort of fluid relationship with things. I mean, you know, Tony Stark went from working in the Vietnam War to working in the Gulf War to moving forward. Peter Parker had been in college for 30-odd years. And the really important thing is not when things happen in a timeline. It's what order to read in. That's the key. And so I guess, having lived through the DC Crisis on Infinite Earths and DC Zero Hour and DC also doing their reboot a few years ago, you know, I guess I kind of have that feeling that if the story matters to you, it still matters. The stories we love, I wrote in A New Dawn, the stories we love may not all fit into a single timeline, but they'll always matter. So, I kind of understand everywhere everybody's coming from, but I do approach stories to the extent as I can as individual objects. Now, about the stories. How stories connect to the larger universe is about us. Every story must succeed on its own. But also, if you do end up working in a tie-in situation, don't just retell the same story. Look for ways to use the shared universe to say something new. And again, it's tempting to retell the same story. It's tempting to go back and just basically put the original thing that you love on shuffle or on remix or whatever. But, you know, one of my former editors used to say, you need to give people not the story that they want, but the story that they need and don't know that they want yet. And so I tend to try to do that whenever possible. You know, the Kenobi novel was a Western. It was a Western romance. It was absolutely not the book that I think anybody was expecting to get. And the people that have criticized the book, other than the people criticize anything, but they're, you know, the people that were caught unawares, a number of them, what they were hoping for is, well, where's the Sith guy that's coming to go hunt down maybe Luke Skywalker or something like that? Or why isn't there a big, you know, device that he needs to go blow up or whatever? Well, the thing is, those are part of Star Wars, and there are stories that you can do about those kinds of things, and that's great. But if I'm just going to be filling in the blanks over and over again, there's already a book for that. You know, one Jedi Knight, one Sith Lord, one earth-shattering device. There's not necessarily room there for you to really expand the universe and tell your own kind of stories. And I guess what I would leave you with is, have fun in whatever sandbox you're working with, whether it's, you know, just a project of your own with a couple of friends or something in a tie-in universe world. But make sure that other authors can have fun too. Make sure that your editors don't not have fun. Make sure that they have fun as well. And above all, make sure that the readers have fun. Thank you very much. We'll do some questions. Dear God, don't send me your fan fiction, please. I have a story here, I'm sorry. I was at a signing, and a guy dropped a flash drive with his story into my stuff. And I was like, I opened it up later, and it's somebody's novel. I'm like, what do I do now? Anyway, that's I wrote him a nice note and said, God bless. I just can't do anything. Where are we here? Thoughts, questions, comments, criticisms? Yes, sir.
When you have a novel, or when you're contracted with LA, do they approach your stories, or do you approach them, and how does that work when you can't?
The decision to actually work with an author is usually made first by the licensor, or by the publishing company, whatever it happens to be. Then it really just depends on how loose the situation is in terms of what's going on in that universe. If it is something where the tie-in fiction is completely irrelevant to what's on the screen and there's no connections back, generally you can go just about any direction you want. If it's something where, for example, Star Trek, you know, the novels are in continuity with each other and with the TV shows, but there's not the grander Lucasfilm story group continuity that we have in Star Wars, there's a little more negotiating room there to sort of say, all right, I want to do this kind of story, and they might come back and say, yes, but it needs to be this ship or that crew or whatever, or this will, if you do this, this will collide with something else. It's one of those things where it's just, you have to understand that you're working with other people. You're working with multiple different people, and you all succeed as a group. One of the things that I never do, or I try never to do, is when something does go wrong, when something is drawn incorrectly or something in a comic book, you'll never hear it from me, because I'm taking credit for the good stuff. So I'm also going to, it's my deal if it didn't work either. So yes, over there. If there were, the question is, have I ever suggested something that somebody said no to because it's off limits? If I did, we wouldn't tell you. if there was something that was off limits, we wouldn't tell you because there was a reason it was off limits. This is probably okay. When I was doing Knights of the Old Republic, I could get somewhat into Revan's history, but I didn't want to go too far with Revan because I didn't know what would happen with Revan in the future. I knew that whoever would be dealing with Revan, it wouldn't be me. And of course, we ended up getting a Revan novel by Drew Karpyshyn that handled his future. And I did not, nothing that I did hopefully caused any problems. To answer that question, we have been told never to ever, never go to the Genesis planet, never go here or there. Well, that's just a screaming sign over the top of it saying something's going to happen at this particular thing. So I wouldn't do that. Yes, right there.
When you're brainstorming, is there anything you do that helps you get in the head of a character that you didn't originally create?
Sometimes I'll watch the films. With New Dawn, I watched the... with New Dawn, I definitely watched the scenes that were relevant in Revenge of the Sith. To know sort of what message it was that Obi-Wan was sending out to everybody or how he was sending it. I have two kids, and so I wear these giant headphones. They're these Black & Decker things which are rated for airport tarmacs. When the FedEx guy shows up and I end up at the door with these things, it's a very strange conversation usually because... I do live at the end of a dead-end road, and why do I have this on? I really kind of need to be immersed in whatever world I'm in, and that's kind of just my personal writing practice. I don't do music or anything right there.
Just really quick, I'm surprised that your editor didn't catch the Breaker
trumpet. The thing is, I can't remember what draft that was.
Okay.
So much more is caught than isn't. But I have to say, there will always be something that isn't caught. I've been in publishing for 25 years. I've never put to bed anything perfect. There's always something. And especially when you're dealing with worlds where there are 20 and 30 books going out at a time for publishing companies. I've got horror stories from magazines that I've edited where, beyond typos on the cover. Where we accidentally ran an article with the headline, Grant's first North American serial rights, which was actually the first line on the top of the manuscript that somebody keyed in, saying, what rights were being granted to us in publishing these things. It is absolutely the case that mistakes happen, and the wonderful thing is we now have a world in which we can fix things in the ebook form, and that happens all the time. I've made some crazy things. I mean, in a New Dawn, as I was proofreading that, I was referring to an element called Baradium 357, And I was making those changes constantly. And then I went over to the Trek book that I was working, and I referred to the Battle of Wolf 357 instead of the Battle of Wolf 359. It was on the brain. That stuff happens, but you know, I'm not going to accidentally put a transporter in where it doesn't belong, I would hope. It's an occupational hazard. Questions, comments, over there.
When something major happens in the books, like a major character or someone dies, like an expanded universe that they've done, is that something that's decided on an event or licensing?
Well, this is what I was saying earlier. You wouldn't do anything really big.
It depends.
You know, sometimes you have situations like, I know that we had Shadows of the Empire, where it was actually a combined thing, where it was a combination of the studio and various licensors working together. Of course, now we have the story group, which streamlines things far more than ever would be. And I've been fortunate to be able to have the input of all of those people who are doing New Dawn. Over here.
Working in the shared group, talking about the role of this, I'm guessing every now and then you might have situations where you have a personal difference or that things will work. What are the kinds of things you do to actually resolve those kinds of situations rather than just swinging each other?
No, it doesn't often happen, because a lot of the time these books are being done at completely different times and by people who don't actually see each other. So you might find out about things that somebody else is doing at a different time. But really, the networking is done by the editors. If you're in a tie-in world, it's your editor who is handling the flow of doing everything, and that's the way it's done. But certainly, you know, again, there are wonderful teams at the licensing companies. Our own Leland Chi, the keeper of the holocron back there with the camera, is an absolute guru. Thank God for all the times we failed us out. because as I say, you know, I haven't read everything, and very few people have read everything. I don't really recall specific incidents like that. It's really been a very collegial and fun. Okay, I think we have time. What's our time here?
It's
2:15. A couple more. In the orange back there, and yes.
I spoke with James Casino from Celebration. He hinted at the separate timeline, the legends, and how the and stuff. And when he wrote about the target, he threw in a little 11-4 Leroy from Legends to the Bar. And is there something that you want to write for one of your non-canon storylines to add into your life?
The books are still on my shelf. They still mean as much as they ever did to me. And so, I mean, yeah, would I enjoy writing certain characters again? Sure. But I would write some of my certain characters I would write for free. But you know, you try to make anything that you're writing interesting. Find the interesting thing in it. You make it fun. And hopefully it makes it fun for the readers too. All the stuff is still out there, and I really love that. Almost all of it is going to continue to be available. You had one right here, is that right?
Yeah. When you wrote A New Dawn with Kanan,
yes.
Did they provide you with the history that they wanted to center around?
Yes. With A New Dawn, I did confer with Dave Filoni and did get notes back from Greg Wiseman and Simon Kinberg, the other executive producers of the series, on my story. And they sort of gave me some notions at the very beginning of what would be good story points to write about. And they said one of them that you could do would be when Kanan first met Hera. And so I did. And I set mine in part when I did, because I wanted to avoid any collisions with something that they were doing right during the show. And I tend to do that. I did Knights of the Old Republic. I said it several years before the video game. Over here?
Yeah, if you're trying to build your own shared universe,
yes,
with a new property, what do you think are the most important elements to focus on? And
yeah,
kind of as a follow-up, when are we going to see Detective Doug?
Well, I tell you, I'd much rather have you go buy Overdraft, which is a book I've got out now. But no, I would actually much rather, in fact, have you go out and buy one of the many fine Star Wars novels that I've got out now. Why don't you do that? In fact, I am doing a signing at 3:30 at the Mysterious Galaxy booth. We rescheduled from 10 or from 11 because there was something going on TV. We didn't quite know what it was. When you're designing your own universe, you want to try to make things as flexible for you as for yourself as possible, because the same rules apply. The person that you could be causing problems for could be yourself. I just wrote myself into a corner here. I've established how things are. You want to be able to go whichever direction. I think I've had time for one more. Is that right? All right. Yes, right there.
So Star Wars spans multiple generations.
Yes.
So what matters to the audience back then, based on their real life experience, is slightly different than what it does to the current audience.
Sure.
How does that affect when you write, or is it just Star Wars, just Star Wars?
I think the spirit of Star Wars is unchanged. The notion of a person living in a situation that's he feels out of it's out of his control. What goes on in the universe? The world is a big place. All sorts of things are going on. It's easy to imagine other people in Luke Skywalker's situation feeling that there's so much going on in the universe, and a lot of bad things going on in the galaxy. But it's all so far away from here. There's no way I can affect things. That's a universal feeling. That's not just within Star Wars, but a lot of other stories across time. And really, I guess I would say capturing that feeling is more important than the specific making sure you've got the right XP number on the land speeder or something like that, or making sure all that stuff is dropped in there. You want to get the feeling of the universe. I want to thank everybody. My website is Far Away Press. I've got a .com. I've got bookmarks up here. Thanks to Del Rey for bringing me out here, and also to Star Wars Celebration for hosting me. I appreciate it. Thank you guys for coming out.